wildfires continue to blaze across western Montana as the National Weather Service issues a severe weather warning. That's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. Good evening, I'm Corin Cates-Carney.
And I'm Conrad Scheid. John Walsh makes the first of three public appearances after his resignation from the U.S. Senate race, and findings are released in the investigation of the June highway crash that killed a family of five and the Three Forks fire chief.
Before our fire coverage this evening, the National Weather Service has instated a red flag warning until midnight tonight across the Salish and Kootenai Reservation, Flathead, and Glacier Park. Red flag warnings indicate a mix of wet and dry storms capable of strong, gusty, and erratic winds. The lightning and dry fuels will make it more likely for new fires to start, and the strong wind will aid in the spread of existing fires. We will have additional weather coverage later in the broadcast. Officials announced today that lightning started a fire on the Beaverhead Deer Lodge National Forest on Sunday afternoon. The Madison Fire is located between Delmo Lake and Whitetail Reservoir and is 1 acre in size. It's burning in steep, rocky terrain filled with beetle-killed lodgepole pine. Due to extreme difficult terrain, fire managers will monitor the fire from the air with patrols on the ground. Officials say they've evaluated the fire and deemed it unsafe for firefighters due to its remote location, continuous dead fuels, and a lack of safe areas. The Thompson River complex consists of three wildfires, the Cuckoo Stint and Spruce and Marmot fires, which started August 1st by lightning and were burning about 6 miles northeast of Thompson Falls. Fire Information Officer Jennifer Kostich says the Cuckoo Stint, which is visible to drivers driving along Highway 200, is not the largest of the fires burning, but is concerning because of its proximity to homes. Fire crews are working in steep and rugged terrain building fire lines, while helicopters and air tankers drop water and flame retardant.
We really are feeling pretty good about the containment lines that have been installed in the north end of the perimeter. The east and southeast flank of the fire nearest the primary residences is still of some concern to us, but our operations folks are feeling cautiously optimistic about that. Yesterday, they were successful in holding some hot spots down there, and so that fire is looking much better for us.
The Spruce Fire is the most active of the three at this point, burning over 800 acres. If you're in Thompson Falls and seeing smoke, Kostich says it's most likely from the Spruce Fire.
That fire a few days ago developed a spot east of West Fork Road and really inaccessible terrain. And crews have been reassessing that frequently. And then the other day when it got some high winds on it, when we had hot temperatures, it made an upslope run to the north and east towards Sundance Ridge.
Kostich says the primary concerns of the Spruce Fire are to prevent it from spreading east and keeping the blaze west of Sundance Ridge. The Marmot Fire is 3 miles further north of the Spruce Fire and is burning about 5 acres. Kostich says the red flag warning put into effect by the National Weather Service could mean hail and winds up to 60 miles an hour in the Thompson River Complex region.
And when we get the potential for winds or hail, it does impact our air operations, and right now air operations are very important to the success of the mission.
321 people are currently working the Toms River Complex fires. Forest officials have closed Cuckoo Stint Trail number 445 as well as Access Road to Trailhead number 18765. Other trail closures include Big Spruce Creek Trail number 1102, Sundance Ridge Trail number 433, and West Fork Thompson River Road 603.
The West Alder Fire, located 20 miles south of Interstate 90 near Bitterroot Flat Campground, has increased in size from 15 to 45 acres since yesterday. Fire Information Officer Boyd Hartwig says a team of 2 helicopters, 2 engines, and 2 20-person ground crews are working to keep the lightning-caused fire from spreading too far east towards Rock Creek and a small group of private homes.
That's kind of northeast of where the main fire is right now. It's a good distance away, and there's no immediate threat there, but they've already located areas where they would take some management action, which could be additional helicopter work, could be retardant, any number of things. If the fire starts moving in that direction and at a pace that could potentially put something at risk.
Hartwig says the red flag warning and a weather forecast full of gusty winds will likely cause the fire to grow. Ground crews will also avoid working too close to the fire because of safety concerns.
Yeah, you don't want to put folks out there in a red flag warning where, you could get a spot fire, you could get some really active fire behavior. And so we'll kind of wait it out. It'll look a little different tomorrow, but probably not a lot different.
Hartwig says the incoming storm will start additional small fires, and fire managers are spreading engines and firefighters across the forest to be in a better position to react to those fires. Forest Service Trail 313 is closed from the Walquist Trail south to Sawmill Saddle. Rock Creek Road is open. The Drew Flat Campground remains open, but will likely be closed once public notification can be made to campers in the area.
In other news from around the state, in his first public appearance since dropping from the U.S. Senate race on August 7th, Senator John Walsh met with Missoula community leaders in the first of three planned visits to Montana cities today to address problems related to Social Security and Medicare. In a press conference after the meeting, Walsh reiterated that the plagiarism charges had become a distraction to his election bid and wanted to focus on completing his Senate term. The U.S. War College Academic Review Board is currently reviewing the charges that Walsh plagiarized over 25% of his 2007 research paper, which was his final paper he completed to earn his master's degree.
Well, you know, that process is ongoing, and I'm cooperating with the Army War College, and you know, that process, we'll see what happens when the process is complete.
The senator had little comment on who he thought would replace him, saying only that the nomination convention would be a very transparent process. The Montana Democrats must name a replacement candidate by August 27th. The party will hold its nomination convention in Helena on August 9th. Walsh emphasized that his family was already moving past the plagiarism scandal.
I spent a year in Iraq with my family back home. Our son deployed twice to Iraq, so that was pretty tough on a family when you send your husband or you send your son or daughter into a combat environment for a year. You know, so I'm very fortunate that I have a very strong support network. My family is very supportive. And so, you know, we are moving on, and we are going to focus on, you know, finishing out this term, you know, in Congress very strong so that we can represent the citizens of Montana the way that they should be.
That Montana Democrat Replacement Committee convention will be held on August 21st, not the 27th. Along with Social Security and Medicare issues, Walsh said he wants to concentrate on veteran suicide and announced a bill he called the Suicide Prevention for American Veterans Act, which he says has bipartisan support.
You know, we have over 100,000 veterans in the state of Montana, and we're losing 22 veterans a day nationwide to suicide. And I'm hopeful that we can get that bill passed so that we can provide our veterans with the care that they need, in addition to the care that they have already received, you know, through the veterans bill.
Walsh, who is a member of the U.S. Senate Special Committee on Aging, heard concerns from 15 leaders on several organizations, including Missoula Aging Services, Community Medical Center, Missoula Senior Center, Missoula Food Bank, and Experience Works. Most of the concerns centered around funding for Social Security and Medicare, access to Social Security offices, and difficulties using government websites.
At least three people say they want to be selected as the Democrats' U.S. Senate candidate at a special nomination convention this weekend. That's State Representative Amanda Curtis of Butte, Wilsall rancher Dirk Adams, and State Senator Dave Wansenried, who recently moved to Billings from Missoula. But the list doesn't include State Representative Frankie Wilmer of Bozeman, who says she will concentrate on her state Senate campaign. Delegates from across the state will gather in Helena on Saturday to choose a replacement candidate for Senator John Walsh, who dropped out of the race last week. Lee Newspapers of Montana reports the 34-year-old Curtis has the support of MEAMFT, the state's largest labor union. The new candidate will face Republican Representative Steve Daines and Libertarian Roger Roots in the November 4th election.
A Highway Patrol official said today that investigators have concluded that a collision between a fire engine and a pickup truck that killed six people was caused by a mechanical failure in the fire engine. Lieutenant Colonel Greg Watson says the break in the fire engine's front drivetrain, which powers the wheels, caused Three Forks Fire Chief Todd Rummel to lose control while driving at 55 miles an hour on U.S. Highway 12, about 10 miles southeast of Helena, on June 19th. The 2002 International Fire Engine veered into the path of the 1997 Chevrolet pickup, carrying a family of five traveling in the opposite direction. The driver of the truck tried to avoid the fire engine, but the vehicles collided on the shoulder of the highway.
The impact ruptured a diesel fuel tank on the passenger side of the fire truck, which resulted in a wide dispersal of diesel fuel that caught fire soon after impact. Both vehicles were engulfed in flames.
Air tanks on the fire truck heated and then exploded. A team of six investigators spent nearly 2 months trying to piece together what happened. Officials' work was made more difficult by the lack of survivors and the devastation of the wreckage.
Though we've been unable to determine which of these parts failed first, We do know that the failure occurred prior to impact and caused the driver of the fire truck to lose control of the vehicle. We also know that prior to the crash, the fire truck had been in Helena undergoing maintenance to its water system, which is completely independent of the vehicle drivetrain.
They determined that Rummel died of smoke inhalation while unconscious. Watson says the family of five died of blunt force trauma on impact. The adults were wearing seatbelts, but the 4-year-old boy and 3-year-old twins sitting in the back seat of the truck's cab were not. Watson referred questions about whether driver was impaired to Jefferson County Sheriff County Coroner Greg Doolittle. Doolittle said the toxicology reports are part of the coroner's investigation, which has not been completed, and he would not release them without a judge's order to do so. Rummel was driving the fire engine back to Three Forks from Helena, where it had been undergoing repairs to its water system. The Highway Patrol does not anticipate filing any charges in the crash. Three recalls were issued for the International 480 models, manufactured in 2002, like the fire engine Rummel was driving, according to the National Highway Safety Administration database. One recall issued in 2003 was for extensive drive shaft angle that could excessively accelerate its failure, causing it to, become separate from the vehicle without warning and fall into the path of other vehicles on the highway, the recall notice read.
U.S. House candidates Ryan Zinke and John Lewis are courting veterans with ideas to make their voices heard and ways to reform the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs in the wake of a scandal. Zinke announced a plan today he says will help veterans receive better care without long delays. The Republican veteran says he supports efforts to reform the VA healthcare system through increased scrutiny and allowing patients to receive care in non-VA clinics. Lewis has created an advisory council open to Montana veterans and their families that he says will help him be responsive to their needs. The group is made up of 17 veterans and others are encouraged to join. Lewis says he plans to hold periodic conference calls with them to hear their concerns.
Missoula officials are planning to eliminate passenger fees on city buses starting January 5th. The city and the University of Montana will head a partnership of public and private entities that will spend $460,000 in each of the next 3 years to subsidize the fares. The Missoulian reports the goal is to increase ridership by 45% to 400,000 passengers per year. The plan was announced Tuesday by the Missoula Urban Transportation District. Chairman Eric Hines says the zero fare plan will help improve the quality of life in Missoula. Transportation District officials say Missoula will become the nation's 40th metropolitan area to have a zero-fee public transit system.
Montana wildlife officials will hold public hearings on a proposal to create a wolf conservation stamp that would allow non-hunters to contribute $20 apiece to help in the management of their predators. The Independent Record reports Fish, Wildlife, and Parks scheduled the 8 hearings after receiving more than 14,000 comments on the proposal. They'll be held Thursday in Helena, Kalispell, Missoula, Bozeman, Great Falls, Billings, Glasgow, and Miles City. Money received from the $20 stamps would first go to the administration of the program, then to livestock loss reduction program grants, wolf monitoring, habitat protection, research, public education, and to hire wardens. FWP officials say the stamps would be considered donations that give others besides hunters and anglers a way to contribute to wildlife management. FWP Director Jeff Hagner will make the final decision on the proposal.
The Flathead Lake Biological Station has scientists conducting research not just on the waters of the crown of the continent, but also the Pacific Rim, South America, and Norway, among others. Each summer, the station opens its doors to the community to showcase some of the different work being done. Flathead reporter Catherine Fry reports it's also an opportunity for people to ask questions they have of the waters in their own backyard.
So this little critter caused amazing changes in the population.
Dr. Bonnie Ellis holds a clear glass jar labeled Mysis Shrimp at a table set up along the shore at Yellow Bay. Behind her are several poster boards with pictures of fish and food that describe the Flathead Lake food web over time.
I mean, they have the potential to change everything in the lake.
Postdoctoral scientist Sean Devlin talks with visitors at a table with pictures and examples of some of the damage aquatic invasive species like zebra or quagga mussels can do. In one of the biological station buildings, the doors are open, tables covered with labeled furs, animal skulls, and taxidermy birds. Sam Schlatter lives nearby and has some familiarity with the Flathead Lake Biological Station.
But I've never been to the open house before, so it's very cool seeing all or what they have here.
Schlatter likes this display with its lineup of wildlife and scuba gear, but also found some of the information at the water quality monitoring site familiar from a school project.
We saw the nitrates, and we took tests of water that we had, because we had fish tanks. Each like table or group had a fish tank, and we measured the nitrates.
Dr. Jack Stanford says at each annual open house, they try to emphasize different research biological station scientists are conducting.
For example, this time, Amanda Delvecchia has her research display about the NIAC stoneflies that she's working on. And then we did create a little film this year for our work that goes on at Kodiak Island on bears and salmon.
Stanford says they also highlight threats to the lake.
We're constantly worried about the next invasive species. Which one will it be? I personally think that large smallmouth bass are a bit of an issue. But also we're really so worried about these mussels.
Stanford says questions people bring range from swimmer's itch to what happened to the Kokanee salmon. He says the open house offers a great chance to connect with the public.
We want the public to know what's going on at their biological station. I mean, if we can't make our science relevant to everyone who lives in the watershed into in the crown of the continent region, then we're not doing our job. What we have, what we learn at the biostation, helps people to understand the resources that they come to view as a part of the quality of their life.
Stanford also says the biological station is engaging the public more and more to help with funding for projects like long-term lake monitoring. He says the station recently met $1 million matching challenge grant with much help from people around the lake. With boat tours on the biological station's research vessel and a look into the tools and gear the scientists use, the open house also might just be a chance to get students like Sam Schlatter hooked on science.
Yes, I enjoy science a lot because I think it's cool to see what you can do, and yeah, I think it's pretty fun.
Kind of figure out the whys of things?
Yeah, exactly.
Katrin Fried reporting from the Flathead.
Forecast calls for cloudy skies over our listening area tonight. Scattered showers and thunderstorms are expected. Lows tonight in the 40s and 50s. Tomorrow look for mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Highs in the mid-80s to lower 90s. Tomorrow night, lows in the upper 40s to mid-50s. And now for the editorial comments of Dan Gallagher.
This is Dan Gallagher with Veterans Viewpoint. Anniversaries, those year-to-year reminders of things past, which are the markers of things still important in our lives. There are common anniversaries such as weddings, graduations, and birthdays, but I'm thinking of those anniversaries of historical importance, days that alter the lives of citizens and nations. Examples include the day the Berlin Wall came down and November 22, 1963, the day John Kennedy was slain in Dallas. And there was August 7, 1964, the day the Tonkin Gulf Resolution was passed by the U.S. House and Senate. Although lacking immediate traumatic impact, it would become one of the most significant political action days ever in the lives and deaths of countless Vietnam-bound GIs and in the life and culture of our country. And that was the day 50 years ago that we went to war in Vietnam, the closest thing to a day of infamy proclamation we had in the Vietnam War. Before that war would end, more than 58,000 young Americans would die. Hundreds of thousands would have war wounds inflicted, and many times more than that would be burdened with the wounds of war that show no scars. Our country would be scarred as well, with Americans of all ages and persuasions feeling the angry divisiveness that was within our borders and within our communities, even within our families, to an extent that hadn't been felt since our own uncivil Civil War. The Vietnam War lingered for 16 years from first casualty till last, making recovery from our estrangement all the more difficult to get beyond, especially for the war's veterans. You know, we were so young back then, we who would become that war's veterans. We still believed back then we hadn't been lied to yet, at least not like we would be. Some might even call us naive, but I prefer the terms idealistic and sincere, and I think that each of us could honestly claim that it was a time, in the words of William Butler Yeats, when I was a boy with never a crack in my heart. It's easy to remember, for those of us seriously impacted by it, how it was back in 64. It was summer and it was very hot. Now it's now so easy to associate the heat of those August days with the heat of war that we would later experience. And it all started. Its origins can be traced to a day in August 1964, 50 years ago. But as I was recently thinking of the embers that were coaxed into flames 50 years ago this August, it occurred to me that there were other Augusts in history that were just as noteworthy in the most damning of ways as was August 1964. For example, 100 years ago in August 1914, guns began firing along the Western Front in Europe, beginning that war to end all wars. After the assassination of the Austrian Archduke in Bosnia, with entangling alliances necessitating mutual declarations of war, a powder keg mentality, old bitternesses, and battle plans that were carved in stone and went into motion almost automatically once the first shot was fired, the continent spun sickeningly and helplessly into a conflagration the likes of which the world had never known before. At least 20 million men and women would die from that war. Governments and empires would fall, and a new world order would emerge, and not necessarily one to be desired. Frankly, many of our international problems today, especially those in the Middle East, were bred and born in the machinations of that war. And it all could have been avoided if only a bit of wisdom and restraint had been applied. You know, one of the very few good things to come from the dark lessons of 1914... In October 1962, in trying to defuse the Cuban Missile Crisis before the world was turned into cinders, President Kennedy applied the insight and lessons written into Barbara Tuchman's book, The Guns of August, and in 1962, a civilization-ending war was avoided. So as we observe the centennial anniversary, we can continue to learn from it. We damn well better. And speaking of August as an anniversary month, in August 1864, 150 years ago, Atlanta fell to Union forces and Sherman began his march to the sea, virtually assuring President Lincoln's re-election bid and a northern victory in the Civil War. In August 1939, 75 years ago, Hitler put his army in position for an attack on Poland, an attack that began World War II. And 137 years ago, on August 9th and 10th, 1877, the Battle of the Big Hole was fought in a gentle valley in western Montana. The commanding general was Union veteran Oliver Otis Hauer. The leader of the Nez Perce band that the cavalry fought was an incredible leader and statesman known to most as Chief Joseph. Now, Howard was later told by General Gibbons of the Fort Missoula cavalry unit that had been in the thick of the battle of how touched he had been at the sight of Nez Perce women jumping into the Big Hole River as the battle raged, with babies in their arms, in order to protect them from the bullets and arrows that were flying. In his subsequent report on that battle, General Howard was articulate as he set the scene and eloquently addressed the pathos that is war. Said Howard, "Now, my readers, if you should take up your skillful pencil, I think you could picture that touching scene and would sadly ask the question, is there no substitute for war?" No, those are words worthy of an anniversary observance. This is Dan Gallagher with Veterans Viewpoint.
Dan Gallagher is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. I'm Corin Cates-Carney.
And I'm Conrad Scheid. Thank you for listening.